This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Initiative Measure Number 732 concerns taxes. The measure would impose a carbon emission tax on certain fossil fuels and fossil fuel-generated electricity, reduce the sales tax by 1 percentage point and increase a low-income exemption, and reduce certain manufacturing taxes. Should this measure be enacted into law? To help answer this question, I have as my guest Yoram Bowman of Carbon Washington, a carbon tax campaign that is currently gathering signatures for I-732. Yoram is a PhD environmental economist who co-authored the 1998 book Tax Shift with Sightline's Alan Derning. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Why propose I-732 to the Washington State Legislature? What is the overall purpose or goal?
So there's a lot of energy right now in Washington State and elsewhere along the West Coast in reducing carbon emissions. And really the goal of 732 is to cut carbon emissions in a way that is beneficial for the economy and will address some of the regressivity in the Washington State tax system at the same time. So it's really a double win. It's going to make the tax system fairer and more sustainable.
What is the proposal? Would you say more?
Absolutely. So the basic idea is to follow up on the terrifically successful carbon tax in British Columbia, which many economists, including myself, think is the best climate policy in the world. So what they did up there was actually passed by a right-of-center government that said, look, we want to do something about climate change, but we don't want to grow government. We don't want to raise the overall level of taxes. We want to be market-friendly. So they implemented a carbon tax, so a tax on fossil fuels. And the revenue from the carbon tax is used to reduce existing taxes in British Columbia. That policy has been in place since 2008. It has successfully reduced carbon emissions. The economy of BC is doing great. Both political parties accept it. And we think that it's a terrific bipartisan way forward for climate action in Washington State and elsewhere in the United States. As you know, Washington State doesn't have an income tax as they have in British Columbia. So the basic premise of our policy is to have a carbon tax, again, a tax on fossil fuels, and use the revenue to cut the state sales tax by a full percentage point. So in very broad strokes, most households in the state will end up paying a few hundred dollars a year more for fossil fuels and a few hundred dollars a year less for everything else. There are also smaller portions of the revenue from the carbon tax that are going to effectively eliminate the business tax for manufacturing in the state as a way to address impacts on energy-intensive trade-exposed businesses. And there's a part that funds what's called the Working Families Rebate, which is a state-level bump up of the federal earned income tax credit. They'll provide up to $1,500 a year for 400,000 working families in Washington State. It's going to be the best improvement to the state tax system, which is admittedly very regressive, but the best improvement in terms of regressivity and social justice since the 1977 ballot measure that eliminated the sales tax from food.
Would you say more about what carbon will be taxed?
Yeah, so it's carbon emissions from fossil fuels. So we're talking coal, natural gas, and petroleum products. And the tax is going to apply based on the carbon content of those fuels. So gasoline, for example, puts out about 19.6 pounds of CO2 per gallon. The carbon tax on gasoline will end up being at $25 per ton of CO2, which is sort of our target rate, about 25 cents a gallon of gasoline. So that's not nothing. But again, we're using the revenue to cut the state sales tax by a full percentage point on the other side in a way to try to make it revenue neutral, both overall and hopefully for most households. We've actually worked with the University of Washington on a carbon tax swap calculator that you can find on our website, carbonwa.org, where you can actually go and enter your own household details and enter how much do you make. It estimates your sales tax savings. How much do you drive? How much do you fly? It estimates carbon tax liabilities. So on the carbon tax liabilities side, we're looking at motor gasoline, jet fuel if you fly, electricity depending on where you live in the state and how carbon intensive your electricity is. Does it come from mostly hydropower like Seattle City Light? Does it come from a more coal-based mix of electricity like Puget Sound Energy if you're in Bellevue or Bainbridge Island or other places around the state? And then home heating. So is your home heating natural gas? Is it electricity? And you can find out more on all those things from the calculator that's on our website.
Would you say more about how the carbon tax will actually be determined?
Yeah, so there's a set carbon content for different fossil fuels. The Energy Information Administration or the EPA, you know, these are well-known numbers. And so the carbon tax simply applies, as in British Columbia, to the carbon content of those fossil fuels. So gasoline, for example, when it comes off the rack, when it comes out of the refinery gate, you know how much carbon is going to go into the atmosphere once that gasoline is burned. And so the carbon tax actually applies at that refinery level. It applies to coal that's being burned in electricity generation. Actually, the carbon tax also applies to imported electricity. So we get a fair amount of coal-fired power from power plants that are in other states. And so we use fuel mix disclosure reports to figure out what the carbon content of that electricity is, and we apply the carbon tax to those sources of carbon emissions also.
And is it correct that the consumer is paying the tax?
The consumer will end up paying the tax. As an economist, I have to be honest and tell you, it would be nice to just say, oh, it's the, you know, the big dirty industries that are paying the tax. But ultimately, carbon emissions come from the fact that we as consumers, we fuel up our cars, we take airplane rides, we heat our homes. And so even if the tax is applied at the refinery gate, let's say, or to the power producer, those taxes are going to get passed on to consumers. And from an environmental perspective, you want the tax to get passed on to consumers because the point of putting a price on carbon is to give everybody, individuals, households, businesses, an incentive to reduce carbon emissions. And if individuals on the consumption end don't see that price increase, they're not going to have a financial incentive to reduce emissions. So as in British Columbia, the tax is going to get passed on to consumers. And the point of the policy is to provide a benefit on the other side. You know, not only are we doing our best to reduce carbon emissions and successfully, you know, addressing climate change, but we're also reducing these other regressive taxes that are currently affecting households and businesses around the state.
Would you underscore what I-732 would do for the environment?
Sure. So it would do great things for the environment is the short answer. Again, if you look at British Columbia, which many economists argue is the best climate policy in the world, they have a carbon tax that's $30 per ton of CO2. So in broad strokes, that's 30 cents a gallon of gasoline, 3 cents a kilowatt hour of coal-fired power. So it's a pretty hefty carbon tax. You compare it with other carbon prices around the world. California has a cap and trade system. It's about $12 per ton of CO2. The East Coast has a cap and trade system, I think $4 or $5 per ton of CO2, maybe even lower in Europe. So $30 per ton of CO2 is a terrific, strong financial incentive. 732 starts at $15 per ton of CO2 in the first year, $25 per ton of CO2 in the second year, and then goes up slowly after that to maintain revenue neutrality, to balance out the sales tax reductions that dominate the other side, along with the working families rebate. If you look at the carbon reductions in British Columbia, they've reduced emissions maybe 10 or 15%, both in absolute terms and relative to Canada as a whole, which is a terrific start. It's not going to get us all the way that we need to go, but it's a terrific start. And I want to emphasize in this point that, you know, the goal of climate policy in Washington State or in British Columbia is not to, quote unquote, solve climate change in Washington State. You know, Washington State, as folks on the right side of the political spectrum like to say, is a third of 1% of global emissions. The point of climate policy in Washington State is to drive national and international policy. And if you look at what a policy like ours would do at the national level, for example, at the national level, we would reduce electricity emissions in half. Roughly overnight, almost overnight. Right? So it is a tremendously strong policy at the local level, and an even stronger policy if you look at what would happen if a similar policy were adopted nationally or internationally.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Jerome Bauman of Carbon Washington. Our topic is Initiative 732, a measure to institute a revenue-neutral carbon tax on CO2 produced by fossil fuels and consumed in the state of Washington. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. How is I-732 likely to affect the economy?
The effects on the economy are going to be similar to what we've seen in British Columbia, because it's a similar policy. And I think overall, what you're going to end up with is individuals and households and businesses are going to be paying a little more for fossil fuels. They're going to be paying a little bit less for everything else because of the reductions in the sales tax. And the economy as a whole is not going to see much of an impact. In fact, there are economic models of British Columbia that argue that the economy up there is actually going to do better with the carbon tax shift, essentially because the economic impacts of the new tax system with the carbon tax are going to be less of a drag on the economy than the previous tax system that they had before. And you could make the same argument here in Washington State. You know, the sales tax is a regressive tax. It's a tax on record stores, on other folks who are selling things subject to the retail sales tax. The B&O tax, the business tax in this state, is a tax that nobody likes. And our proposal is going to help to address that as well. If you talk to a lot of economists say that we should move towards more of a consumption-based tax system instead of taxing investment. And, you know, the carbon tax proposal that we're talking about is a step in that direction.
Are there individual types of businesses that will be hurt or helped by I-732?
So most businesses are not energy intensive. And so as a result, yes, they'll pay a little bit more for fossil fuels, for electricity, but those aren't a major part of their bottom line. And they're going to get offsetting sales tax reductions on the other side. Businesses actually pay about a third of the sales tax in the state of Washington. So for most businesses, software businesses, you know, an organization like KEXP, it's not going to have much of an impact, but it's still going to provide an incentive to move in a more sustainable direction in terms of operations, simply because the prices of fossil fuels are going to go up and the prices of other things are going to go down. As an economist, I worry a little bit more about energy-intensive businesses, especially what are called energy-intensive trade-exposed businesses that are competing with other companies that are outside of the state. So we've got a steel mill here in Seattle. They're competing with steel mills in China, steel mills elsewhere in the United States. And that's why there's this part of our policy that uses the revenue from the carbon tax, part of it, to effectively eliminate the business tax for manufacturing in the state. And we think, based on the case studies that we've done, that a lot of manufacturers are going to come out roughly even. Some of them may come out ahead. I think it's possible, of course, that some of them may come out a little behind. But overall, we think that energy-intensive trade-exposed businesses are going to be covered pretty well by this tax swap that we're looking at.
What do you see as the benefits of proposing a revenue-neutral plan?
So the advantage of revenue neutrality is, one of the benefits is that we can get bipartisan support. So admittedly, there aren't all that many folks on the right side of the political spectrum right now who care all that much about climate change, but I think they're growing, and we think that it's important to reach out to those folks and to really come up with a policy that they can support. And there are folks on the right side of the political spectrum who do care about climate change, and they pretty quickly go to this idea of, hey, let's reform the tax system in a way that doesn't grow government, that's in line with our philosophy, if they have a small government philosophy, but that provides market signals that are going to address externalities, that are going to address these environmental impacts from carbon emissions. And so we have folks like Todd Myers, who's the environment director of the Free Market Washington Policy Center. He's on our advisory board. He happens to like revenue-neutral carbon taxes, and we're honored that he's on our advisory board. And the polling that we've had access to suggests that our policy is a pretty decent way of reaching out to voters who are on the right side of the political spectrum, who can say, hey, here's a climate policy that makes sense to us. So that's one of the reasons to move in a revenue-neutral direction. I think the other part of it is that from a tax reform perspective, the things that we're funding, the tax reductions that we're funding, are incredibly valuable. So the sales tax is a very regressive tax in the state. Reducing the sales tax is going to alleviate some of the burden of that tax on households, especially low-income households around the state. Reducing the business tax for manufacturers in the state is going to be a huge benefit for those firms, especially ones that are going to end up paying a bit more in the carbon tax. And a portion of the revenue goes to fund the working families rebate, which is a terrific policy. It's a state-level bump up of the federal earned income tax credit. It's going to provide up to $1,500 a year for 400,000 working families in Washington state. If you go to our website and look at our blog, we have a blog post called Carbon Taxes Are Even Better Than You Think in Terms of Social Justice. And the impacts on the regressivity of the state tax system are amazing. It's going to be a terrific policy.
Well, you've been referring to this, actually, but why not just give the revenue back as a per capita dividend?
That's a great question. And there's a group called Citizens Climate Lobby that we're honored to have an endorsement from, and that we think is a terrific group that advocates for just such a policy on the national level. So they argue for what's called fee and dividend. Have a carbon tax, take the revenue and give it back to everybody on a per capita basis. So a per capita dividend like the Alaska Permanent Fund, for example. I think that makes a great deal of sense, especially on a national level. And I think the work that Citizens Climate Lobby is doing is terrific. I encourage all your listeners to join up with CCL chapters around the state and around the world, in fact. And the challenge in Washington state with that, I would say, is twofold. One is that there's an element of the Washington state constitution that says that the government cannot make gifts of public funds except to the poor and infirm. And this was an attempt to avoid, you know, nepotism and backhanded dealings by the state government. And there are legal concerns about whether a dividend that applies to everybody in the state, where everybody gets a check, whether that would run foul of the state constitution. So that's one concern, probably the main concern. A secondary concern, I think, as an economist, I would say, is that a dividend approach makes a lot of sense at the national level, where you can have things like border tax adjustments that address impacts on manufacturing, especially manufacturers that are competing with folks outside of the country. It makes a little bit less sense, I would argue, at the state level, simply because it's hard to do a border tax adjustment at the state level And so you need to have some element of the policy that's going to think about how to address impacts on manufacturers in particular. So our policy does that with reductions in the B&O taxes. It might be possible to cobble together something where you do a dividend plus some reductions in manufacturing taxes. But I think really the attraction of the dividend approach is that it's simple and super clear and easy to explain. And once you make it more complicated, you lose some of that attractiveness. So I like the dividend approach at the national level. I think that our approach makes a little more sense at the state level, especially in Washington State, where we have these constitutional restrictions.
Would you underscore the social justice aspects of I-732?
Absolutely. So there was a study by the Institute on Tax and Economic Policy called Who Pays, you can find online. And they looked at the state and local tax system in all 50 states. And the results are really stunning, although perhaps not a surprise to many of your listeners. You know, you look at states like Oregon, everybody in Oregon, no matter what your income is for different income groups, pays about 8% of their household income in state and local taxes in Oregon. In Idaho, it's about the same, 8%. California is a little bit of a higher tax state, maybe 10%. But again, it's relatively flat across the board in terms of how much of their income different income groups pay in taxes. You look at Washington State. Washington State was named the most regressive tax system in the nation. Low-income households ended up paying about 16 or more percent of their income in state and local taxes. Higher-income households ended up paying maybe 2% of their income in state and local taxes. A lot of that comes because we don't have an income tax in Washington State, and we rely quite heavily on the sales tax and the B&O tax, which is similar to a sales tax. So what we can do to address that with climate policy is a couple things. One is that climate policy in itself, by reducing carbon emissions, is going to have a social justice benefit because the impacts of climate change affect low-income households more than they affect higher-income households. The second benefit from climate policy is through what are called co-benefits. So by reducing carbon emissions, by reducing fossil fuel consumption, we're also reducing the production of lots of local air pollutants, particulate matter, sulfur dioxide, that disproportionately target hotspots that are often in low-income communities. The third thing that we're doing is we're funding the working families rebate. And as I mentioned earlier, it's a terrific policy that's going to put money back in the pockets of low-income households in Washington State. The federal earned income tax credit, which is what the working families rebate is based on, is the largest anti-poverty program in the United States. It has, or at least until recently, had bipartisan support in Congress. You know, it was expanded under Ronald Reagan. They're talking right now in Washington, D.C. Both political parties want to expand the earned income tax credit for families without children who currently don't get that much of a credit because it has bipartisan appeal. What it says is if you're low income and you're working, the government is going to top up your income. It's going to provide you a bonus as an encouragement for engaging in market activity for working. And that program at the national level has some bipartisan support and hopefully will be expanded. And what we're doing at the state level is providing a 25% bump up of that national policy. There are about 25 states around the country that have state level programs that boost the federal earned income tax credit. And Washington State, through this working families rebate, is going to fund that at the 25% level. It's actually a policy that currently exists on the law books in Washington State at the 10% level. But it's actually never been funded in Washington State. It just sits there because it doesn't have a funding source. So what our policy does is provides a funding source through the carbon tax, and we increase the amount of the working families rebate from 10% of the federal EITC, federal earned income tax credit, to 25%. So ultimately, it's going to provide up to $1,500 a year for 400,000 working families in Washington State, and that's going to be terrific in terms of improving the social justice aspects of the state tax system.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Jerome Bauman of Carbon Washington. Our topic is Initiative 732, a measure to institute a revenue-neutral carbon tax on CO2 produced by fossil fuels and consumed in the state of Washington. Governor Inslee proposed a carbon cap-and-trade bill for carbon in this year's 2015 Washington State legislative session. Why are you proposing I-732 rather than supporting Governor Inslee's cap-and-trade proposal?
So we're positioning ourselves as the relief pitcher now that the baseball season has started. And the idea is that, you know, we're not opposed to the governor's policy, and we don't see ourselves in competition with the governor's policy. In the same way that in baseball, the relief pitcher is not in competition with the starting pitcher. It's just that in baseball terms, 2% of starting pitchers make it all the way through the game. And so we see ourselves as the relief pitcher, whereas unfortunately, the governor's policy has really struggled in the state legislature. There's still a chance. we think it'd be terrific if it passed. And if it did, then, you know, we would all have a party and celebrate. But there's a high likelihood that the governor's bill is not going to end up in the budget this year. And we think that November 2016 is a can't miss opportunity for climate action. There's going to be a presidential election, and folks who care about climate change disproportionately, especially young people, people of color, are going to be turning out disproportionately to vote in November 2016. We think that's a can't miss opportunity. That's why we're pushing our initiative to the legislature now. And there's actually evidence that our efforts are actually helping the governor's efforts in Olympia. There was an article in Crosscut a week or two ago that quoted Joe Fitzgibbon, who's the head of the House Environment Committee, as saying that the governor's climate bill is rising from the ashes. And the reason it's rising from the ashes was because of outside pressure from Carbon Washington, because legislators see, oh, there's this initiative campaign out there. We better try to take a crack at making something happen in the legislature before the voters take it out of our hands.
What do you see as the benefits of your carbon tax proposal compared to cap and trade?
Let me answer that question as an economist. I'll put my wonky economist hat on for a second, and then we can talk about the politics. So from the economics perspective, the two policies, carbon taxes and cap and trade systems, are both ways to put a price on carbon. They're a lot more similar than they are different. So from an economics perspective, anything you do with one, you can do with the other. And it's certainly possible to have good cap and trade systems. And it's possible to have good systems of either type and bad systems of either type. I think the advantage of a carbon tax approach over a cap and trade approach, having said that there are lots of similarities in theory, is if you actually look at the way that they've been implemented in practice, I think the carbon tax approach has shown that you can get a higher price on carbon. British Columbia has $30 per ton of CO2, whereas most cap and trade systems are around $5 or $10 or $12 at most per ton of CO2. So there's a benefit if you think that the important part of putting a price on carbon is getting a strong price on carbon, then I think the carbon tax approach is a better way to go. I also think there are benefits from the simplicity and transparency of a carbon tax approach. I like to say that the BC carbon tax is so simple to explain that you can actually explain it in a haiku. So here's my haiku. I'm very proud of this. It's fossil CO2, $30 for each ton, revenue neutral. Thank you very much. So the California cap and trade system is a little bit more like War and Peace, which doesn't necessarily mean that it's bad, right? War and Peace is generally recognized as one of the best novels ever written, but it is more complicated. So I think from the perspective of simplicity and transparency, I think a carbon tax approach is superior. And I'll say one last thing, which is that, again, we're looking to do something that's going to get some bipartisan support. And right now, the folks on the right side of the political spectrum who care about climate change, and there are some out there, they prefer a revenue-neutral carbon tax approach, and that's why we're pursuing one.
If Governor Inslee's bill fails in the legislature, it is possible that a cap-and-trade plan would be put forward as an initiative to the voters. How would this affect I-732? There might be two proposals, both having to do with carbon taxes.
So I think the environmental community, and we've talked with others in the environmental community, I think that there's a consensus that we don't want to have two competing ballot measures on the ballot in November 2016. That would be kind of a disaster. So we're going to make sure to avoid that. I think that, honestly, you look at what's on the table right now. And what's on the table right now is Inslee's proposal, which is in the legislature, and the Carbon Washington ballot measure, Initiative 732. So I think that if and when there's a point where somebody else says, hey, we have an idea for a ballot measure, then we can have a discussion about, well, you know, which one is better and which one should we go with. But right now, it's a little hard to kind of argue between something and nothing. Right now, the something that's on the table is Initiative 732. We think that it's got terrifically strong merits. We don't want to say negative things about any other potential campaign that's out there, but we're happy to make the case for our proposal because we think it's a strong proposal. We think it's got great environmental benefits. We think it's got great social justice benefits, and we think it's going to be a world-leading proposal.
What would be the timeline for implementation of I-732?
So we're collecting signatures this year through the end of the year. So we're running what's called an initiative to the legislature. So we have until the end of the year to collect signatures. I hope your listeners will volunteer to help out through our website, carbonwa.org. Once we get enough signatures, it'll actually go to the legislature in January of 2016. They either pass it, in which case it becomes law, or it ends up on the ballot in November of 2016. We hope that it will become law either through the legislature or at the ballot in November of 2016. And at that point, the implementation is that the carbon tax would start at $15 per ton of CO2 in July of 2017, accompanied by a half point reduction in the state sales tax. The carbon tax would go up to $25 per ton of CO2 in July of 2018, accompanied by an additional half point reduction in the state sales tax. And then it would increase thereafter to maintain revenue neutrality with the sales tax reduction.
Who has endorsed I-732 so far?
We have some endorsements from a lot of grassroots activist groups around the state. So Citizens Climate Lobby as a national organization, as well as many of the, I think there are 14 Citizens Climate Lobby chapters around the state of Washington, are active in the campaign, and we're delighted to have their endorsement. We have an endorsement from many local groups like Climate Action Bainbridge. We have a sign-on letter from economists around the state. So more than 40 economists from around the state at universities and in private practice have endorsed the general idea that we're pursuing with the revenue neutral carbon tax. We have political leaders, folks like Ron Sims, who have endorsed the measure. So we think we have a strong group of endorsements, and we're building them. If you go to our website, you can see the endorsements that we have from NGOs, from business leaders, and from economists.
How many signatures do you need, and how many do you have so far?
So we've just started signature gathering a few weeks ago. We need 250,000 valid signatures to get on the ballot. That means we need 315,000 total signatures, because sometimes people sign twice or they move or their address is illegible. So 315,000 signatures by the end of the year. Right now, we're just nearing our first kind of big tally at the end of April, because we really have just started a couple of weeks ago. And I think we're pushing the 10,000 mark. We will release details of that in the days ahead once we finish up the April tally. But things are going really well. We have 14 chapters of Carbon Washington around the state that are all working hard, doing events, collecting signatures, and a lot of individual volunteers who are helping out, either just collecting signatures from friends and family. We did an Earth Day 22 campaign where we asked folks to gather 22 signatures from friends and family in honor of Earth Day. Even though Earth Day has passed, we're still happy to have folks participate in that. And then we have folks like Bob Jeffers Schroeder, who's pledged to gather 1,000 signatures by the end of April. And as far as we know, is on track to do that. Like we said, we haven't yet tallied the April numbers, but he keeps coming into the office with stacks of completed signatures and is really an inspiration to the whole campaign.
Where does your funding come from?
Funding comes from a lot of individual donors, and a lot of it is relatively small dollar. So we have some folks, myself included, who are in a position to write a $10,000 check for the campaign. So we've been happy to get some of those checks, but we've also gotten a lot of checks from folks who are contributing $50, $100 on our website, $20. We have this crowdfunding campaign. I'll also be honest and say that we're running a very tight campaign on the other side. So I'm a volunteer with the campaign. There are a lot of other folks who are volunteers. And then we have a staff of 8 people who are managing the campaign and coordinating volunteers and helping to push the campaign forward.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I would like your listeners to know that there's a really terrific climate policy out there. It is the carbon tax in British Columbia that, you know, a lot of folks don't even know about, even though we're right next door. There's sort of the classic, most boring headline in the world of worthwhile Canadian initiative. And the BC carbon tax kind of fits into that model. More folks should know about the success of the climate policy in British Columbia, the revenue neutral carbon tax in British Columbia, in part because it works, in part because it has garnered bipartisan support. And they should know that we're looking to push bipartisan climate action in Washington state as well. 2016 is a can't-miss opportunity for climate action in Washington state. We have a chance to really show the nation that there's a way to move forward on climate change in a way that's bipartisan, a way that's going to improve the environment and improve the economy at the same time. We think a revenue-neutral carbon tax is a way to do it, and we hope folks will join the campaign.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Yoram.
My pleasure.
You were just listening to Yoram Bauman of Carbon Washington speak about I-732. For more information, check on the web at carbonwa.org. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week on Listener Powered 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.